Content warning. This podcast contains depictions of and discussions on gender-based violence. Audience discretion is advised.
It's happened to us all. A negative experience on social media. Either you're a victim or you've seen someone else be targeted. A mean comment, a public shaming, even an incident of cyberstalking. Often these issues are isolated to the online world, but way too often have impacts on our well-being in real life.
Well, it's interesting because I think often when we're talking about the digital world, we think of it as a place that's separate from the regular world, where really it's the same thing.
This online world means free-flowing communication and constant updates on our activities and locations. And that has consequences for us all. But the risks for victims of gender-based violence are profoundly higher.
There's so much intersection and overlap, and I think digital technologies are just increasingly playing a role when it comes to gender-based violence. So, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, you know, as we really started to see Web 2.0, smart technologies emerge, we started to see how digital technologies were being used to facilitate gender-based violence. And this has really just taken off as technology progresses, as technology becomes more embedded in everybody's everyday life.
Imagine if someone who had hurt you, someone you were afraid of, a person you desperately tried to escape, was using social media to track your every move. Community groups, friends, family, all watching and sharing. Imagine if gossip had unimaginable consequences.
One of the biggest issues is that definitely in a small community, people are very ready to exchange information about you or where you are, the gossip about that. They don't really think about the repercussions. A lot of people have opinions based on who somebody's family is or who might be in the wrong in a potential situation.
You know, lives are at stake. You know, the impact of tech-facilitated gender-based violence on survivors, we know it's traumatizing and harmful, similar to other forms of gender-based violence. But we also know that victims are dying by suicide or they're being murdered by their abusive partner because they've experienced tech-facilitated gender-based violence or the abusive partner has used technology to send those threatening messages. So victims dying because of tech-facilitated abuse is the real-world problem of its impact and why tech-facilitated gender-based violence needs to be addressed.
Intimate partner violence, abuse, and harassment are routinely linked with efforts to monitor and control. Women fleeing intimate partner violence are increasingly being terrorized and manipulated using these digital means. Welcome to Somebody Must Say These Things. I'm your host, Ginger McPhee. In this episode, we will be trying to understand the impact of intrusive social media surveillance and its use in facilitating intimate partner violence, abuse, and continued harassment, even after a woman tries to rebuild her life.
The first transition house came to be in Nova Scotia in 1978.
It's a super special Monday night as Wayne and Schuster meet themselves.
It is with very great pride and pleasure that I have signed the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement between Canada and the United States.
Hey there with that knot to tie.
Grow with us.
People got together and they solicited the government. They said, we need money and we need it for this and this is why.
This is Lori McGinnis. She's the counseling supervisor at the Halifax Transition House Association and their shelter, Bryony House.
And it was that coming together that, you know, the culmination of all those voices and the need, they showed the need. So I think that there is great power in voice.
However, since then, All of our lives have been transformed by instant communications.
I love and I hate digital media.
This is Susie Dunn, assistant professor of law at the Dalhousie Schulich School of Law. Her studies focus on the intersections of law and the digital world.
There's such wonderful things that digital media has been able to do. You know, I think about someone who exists today compared to 30 years ago, and the amount of information you can find about where to get help. You can find people who've experienced similar forms of gender-based violence as you. You can find support systems. There's been incredible advocacy campaigns that have been so successful. So I think digital media in some ways is really empowering and really helpful and has helped shift a lot of the narrative and shift a lot of the norms around how we talk about and think about gender-based violence. But then on the flip side, we also see some of the more challenging media spaces that exist when we look at people like Andrew Tate or incels or the power and ability of people like Jordan Peterson who don't believe in women's sexual autonomy or transgendered people's rights. You know, the digital media can allow this amplification of those voices, and particularly with the way that digital media uses algorithmic decision-making to feed content to people, what we know is that content that gets high clicks, which can often be misogynistic, controversial, aggressive content, will often get pumped in to someone's feed because of the way that the algorithm prefers feeding content that gets a lot of clicks versus content that's actually better for the world. When it comes to the digital world, because there are elements of permanency to it, it can have extreme reputational damage. And so we've seen some very specific examples in Canada where abusive ex-partners have actively sought to destroy their partner's reputation online, either creating fake websites about them or fake content about them, or even posting real content that's just embarrassing online. And so I think some of the larger impacts is that once your digital identity has really been tarnished, it can impact your ability to find work, it can impact your ability to find romantic relationships, social relationships, and it can be very expensive to manage. So if you're trying to get that type of content down, so if your name's been affiliated with a sexual video that's posted across dozens of porn sites, and when you search your name, that's the first thing that comes up. A lot of these women have to pay various companies, some of which are predatory and aren't actually that helpful, to try and get all of this content taken down. And so it can be very expensive.
How do our two worlds, real and digital, intersect with one another?
Dad, and I'm Dasha.
When we installed internet access on our computer, I got the whole family involved.
Now that I've gotten on the internet, I'd rather be on my computer than doing just about anything.
It's really cool.
A lot of times, people aren't necessarily looking, right? Like, they're not looking specifically on YouTube or TikTok or things for online misogyny, right? But it's the algorithms of some of these platforms that drive these videos or tutorials or influencers to young people, and then they kind of get stuck in a loop.
This is Rhiannon Wong. She's the Technology Safety Project Manager for Women's Shelters Canada. Her work focuses on technology-facilitated gender-based violence.
They watch things and then it becomes ingrained, like, oh, you know, that's cool or that's so funny. And you know, that's sort of how it starts. I think also, you know, this generation of young people has grown up with technology. And so oftentimes the border, the boundary between what's a healthy relationship online or through dating partners is blurred, right? So they don't understand necessarily that someone probably shouldn't be texting you 100 times in the course of 2 or 3 hours, or someone shouldn't be tracking your look. There's no need for somebody to be tracking your location at all times. And so I think that boundary is blurred with young people.
Yeah, it definitely complicates things.
This is Dr. Caitlin Mendez, Associate Professor at Western University's Department of Sociology. She's the Canada Research Chair for Inequality and Gender.
I mean, part of the trouble is that their messages are really seductive. not everything that they say is bullshit. They're really kind of tapping into real anxieties that boys and young men have. And they're presenting simple solutions like, oh, you want to find a romantic partner? Well, here are like three simple steps that you can take. They really reduce a lot of like complexity in society down to biology, right? So you can't find a partner. Well, it's because you're not man enough. So you need to simply like bulk up, become more of a man, become more aggressive. And they really tap into kind of these ideas that there's fundamental differences between men and women that like society can't overcome. And again, I think, you know, if you're a young person and maybe you have been sexually frustrated, maybe you're on dating apps. And, you know, before dating apps, you know, if you go and ask someone out, maybe you get rejected like once a day or once a week. Well, on dating apps, you can get rejected like tens or hundreds of times in a day. And I can imagine how hurtful that must feel. And so you go online and you see these men who are very successful. They seem to be doing very well financially, and they're offering you just like really simple solutions. I think it's really easy to buy into it. And again, because not everything that they say is bullshit. You know, they talk about role models. They talk about like getting in shape. Like these are things that I think as a society would be like, oh, that's great. Like these are things you can do to like improve your self-confidence. It's just that when they start talking about how women are meant to be dominated, or as a man, you need to kind of dominate and control and use these women, I think that's when things are really troubling. And one thing that we see a lot, and I hear it from teachers, for example, is how there's a lot of language that's emerged from this, the manosphere. That's kind of how we can think of this online culture, is really infiltrating general society. So we have kind of key terms like, you know, most people know what an incel is, or we can think about alphas and betas as a way to talk about like sexually successful men versus sexually unsuccessful men, or Chads and Stacys. And, you know, there's a great researcher named Dr. Salzabel Almansori. She's at Windsor, and she's looking at like teachers and how they're responding to the increased rise of this manosphere rhetoric in schools, and how what can teachers do to try to kind of combat these sorts of manosphere ideologies. And, you know, we hear anecdotally a lot about how young boys and men in particular will go and really challenge their women teachers, again, because they're kind of like so infused with these ideas of the manosphere.
Yeah, what's at stake here? I think it's an interesting question, because honestly, in many ways, it feels the same. In the way that I think feminists have been fighting for basic equality and basic gender rights and freedom and safety forever.
Once again, Professor Susie Dunn.
You know, sometimes I feel frustrated. I look back in the history of advocates who've been arguing for women's safety and arguing against violence against women for hundreds of years. And I think we've advanced. I think we have moved forward. I think right now we are in a step backwards moments of time. I think that there is a significant backlash against feminism. I think that there is an increase in misogyny. I think that there is a normalization of sexually victimizing women on the internet that heightens things and changes things. But to be completely frank, like, I don't know how different that is from historic misogyny. I think that we're still continuing the same battles as we were when we had to change a lot of the language around physical and sexual consent. Now we're having to do that in the digital sphere. So I do recognize it's different, it's unique, but I would hate to suggest that we're experiencing some new form of misogyny when I think it's just the old thing wrapped up in a new bow.
So I guess this is a story of how it changed our lives. Maybe it will yours too.
Social media is one aspect, but our smartphones are packed with technology that can pose a risk to a victim's safety.
Just because you left doesn't mean you're completely detached.
Again, Lori from Bryony House.
Technology is helpful, but in the situations that I see, it has its good and it has its bad. We always get our clients when they come to the house to turn off their GPS and their phone. And then there's kids. So if you have kids, you want your children to still talk to their father. So we have to do FaceTime, but the mother has to be there to ensure that he is speaking appropriately. And so she has to monitor that. And so he knows she's there. And so he'll say things that makes her have to respond. It's, again, it's a vicious cycle. It's, you know, it serves its purposes, but it is a tool for an abuser to use.
Digital technologies make it so much more challenging because it's not only that you physically have to distance yourself, maybe you have to move homes, you have to hide, but you also really need to take a lot of care with your social media accounts or your online profiles or presence.
Dr. Mendes had this to say.
So whether it's your LinkedIn account, whether it's a Facebook page that you opened up, or if there's different apps with like geolocation, you know, sometimes people have geolocation on and they may have forgotten about it, whether it's like Google Maps and your location has been set to share. It can be very easy for abusers to take advantage of that. Or, you know, maybe you haven't changed your password in a while and they know your password. So we're also seeing where abusers go in and take over people's social media profiles as well. So that's one form of control, right, and abuse that happens, but also using social media and digital technologies to stalk and survey. That's like a really big problem. So even if maybe they don't have access to your account, oh, I can see on Instagram that you were at this place, or I can see on various social media accounts, like where you were. So this is something that transition houses really have to have, you know, not just kind of safety plans, but the safety plans have to incorporate digital technologies and really thinking through ways that you can kind of clean your phone or make sure that your phone isn't being tracked, or that other devices like AirTags haven't been, you know, secretly put in your car or kind of like on you, because we also have had stories where those sorts of technologies have been used to track women as well.
We've seen some interesting new technologies such as Apple AirTags and location devices that are being used for stalking in many ways.
Once again, Professor Susie Dunn.
When it comes to intimate partner violence and stalking, we've seen things like Internet of Things devices, so your smart thermometer, your smart stereo system, your home security system, the Ring doorbell being used to track, manipulate, and harm people. What we mean when we talk about the Internet of Things are devices that are somehow internet connected. So for example, if you have a refrigerator that's connected to the internet and it can keep a track of your shopping list, or if you have a Ring doorbell that when you're at the office, you can look at the video online and see what's there, that's the type of technology it is. And so there are some really interesting novel ways that technologies are being used and in some ways creating new forms of harm. But ultimately what we see is that abusive people who have the intention to cause harms are just adopting these technologies and finding ways to access their victims in creative and novel ways through the use of these new technologies. But often the underlying core behavior hasn't changed that much.
Yeah, so we surveyed shelter and transition houses across Canada from December 2022 to January 2023.
Here's Rhiannon again.
And those shelter and transition house workers who support survivors of domestic violence every day in their work said that harassment and threats via technology were actually the two most common forms of tech-facilitated gender-based violence that they saw in their work. The third most common type of tech-facilitated gender-based violence is actually location tracking, which, you know, when I first started this work in 2007 was not the case at all. I think largely due to the technology itself, this is becoming more common because tech that we use every day, like our phones, your smart TVs, our tablets, our smart assistants, like they all have the ability to track our location, which makes it easier for those capabilities to be misused.
So a lot of people who work in transition houses and different shelters and places that are meant to be safety centers for people fleeing abuse, one of the challenges with technology that comes up is there's also location tracking data.
Professor Dunn had this to say.
And it's really difficult to disappear from the world in the way that if you used to be involved with an abusive relationship, you could quit your job, you could move to another town, and maybe that person might not be able to find out where you are. But in the realities of the digital world, often for our workplaces, for our social lives, for all of these things, we're available, and people who are persistent are able to come and find us. And with a lot of domestic violence workers, they're expected to keep up on this technology. And it's such a challenge. The technology is always evolving. The technology is always changing. And historically, people would know how to manage helping someone with physical violence because there's really repetitive patterns that come with that. And people were very well trained, very well versed in that. But now working in domestic violence and various support systems, you also have to figure out what are the safety features on TikTok? What are the location tracking options on your phone? What is the best way that we can collect digital evidence records of the harassment that you're experiencing? And you think about like all of these like interesting hackers who are doing it, but really dedicated abusers, right, can also use these technologies and they find insights.
Leaving a partner safely can be made all the harder by the ease of communication.
When a woman leaves intimate partner abuse, she often is still very much in love with her abuser.
Lori from Bryony House.
People will think, what? That can't, yes, it can be. She doesn't like the way that she's being treated. She doesn't want the abuse. She doesn't want the verbal abuse, the physical abuse, the sexual abuse. She doesn't want her children to be abused. But she is still often in love with this abuser. It wasn't all bad, always, but it turned into that. And sometimes it turned into it recently, and sometimes it turned that way shortly after they got together. So technology is kind of, you know, a good and a bad. They keep accepting messages, they answer them, which we don't like to tell our clients what to do because they've already been told what to do for however long they've been in the abusive relationship. So we give them options, we give them information. So if you keep responding, do you think this will happen? Or if you keep responding, do you think this will happen? We want them to start, number one, making their own decisions, but thinking about the decisions, so making informed decisions. But it's hard. So technology does allow the abusers to continue to perpetrate the abuse through gaslighting, through threats. I'm going to do something to your dog. You know what I mean? They use it to keep control, because when a woman leaves her abuser, that is one of the two times that she is most at risk by her abuser, because when she leaves, he has lost control of her.
Many rural communities use Facebook pages and groups to share local news and updates. The smaller, close-knit populations have a thinner barrier between the online and real world. Again, here's Dr. Mendez.
This has been an issue that's come up in a lot of our focus groups. So schools will have their own, with schools, they talk about Instagram. So Instagram seems to be kind of like the account, but I suppose for older people, it's probably Facebook. So schools will have these Instagram accounts, which are just gossip pages. And exactly, they'll be posting rumors, malicious kind of content. And so this is really common, I would say, in almost every focus group we've done. This is something that we're absolutely hearing. I think it's harmful no matter the size of the community, but I imagine in smaller communities, you know, maybe kind of maintaining that sense of privacy can be more difficult, and why these sorts of groups can be more challenging. It can perhaps be a little bit easier to kind of fade into the background in like a bigger school or a bigger city, but when it's smaller communities, I think these kinds of platforms can really rip those communities apart. But yeah, just last week I was being interviewed here in London. There was two students that reported it. Actually, they went straight to the media and reported about this Instagram account that had been set up in their school. So I was talking to CTV News about this, and again, the harm. And actually in the report, the students were talking about how harmful this was and devastating when you see yourself appear in these kind of gossip pages. It can be really hard for young people because I think they really often feel like this is the end of the world. And like young people in particular are often given this message that like once something's out there forever. So whether it's gossip or an image or anything like that. And so I think young people really feel like there's no hope, there's no going forward. How do you bounce back from this? And I think that's something that we also need to think about, the kinds of messages that we're giving to young people about, yeah, you can get content taken down. And you need to know about the tools and how to do that, how to report it. And, you know, it's not enough to just say this Facebook group or Instagram account hurts my feelings. You need to know how it violates Instagram's community standards so that Instagram gets it taken down. So you need to have a bit of kind of that savvy in order to know how to address and get these things removed.
Being in a small community, yes, everybody knows everybody. There's a lot of groups on Facebook where people essentially just gossip and like everybody in the town is on them. It's also the type of place, and of course, we caution women when they come in about this, that enough people have been in transition house that they know if they can see a little tiny corner of our building, they know it's our building. They can know our parking lot. You know what I mean? So we had somebody post a selfie before because they were feeling, you know, positive and everything. And somebody posted right on her picture on Facebook, oh, you're in transition house, which she hadn't thought about because she was like, you couldn't really see anything. We had had to really caution people like that. And 100% people will say stuff like so-and-so is in transition house and post it all over Facebook and not have any concerns about it. There's also things like there's only so many pharmacies. They might be on methadone or something like that, or they might have other prescriptions and they have to go to the same place to get these prescriptions. And so very easily somebody can pick them out. They know where they're going, all that kind of stuff.
This episode is not supposed to be a complaints list against social media. The women of Thans have innovated, using it as an amazing tool for connection and healing. We must change the narrative and use it as a force for good. Once again, Professor Susie Dunn.
Yeah, so I think the first thing that we do to fight back against this is that we have governments fund programs and we have governments fund research so that we have evidence-based research and policies and programs that are proven to be effective and that aren't based on fear-mongering. And the thing that makes me feel really hopeful, especially talking to young people, is how innovative and creative they are in solving a lot of these problems on their own. I was just talking to a young person the other day, a trans person who was saying that they'd figured out how to code something on their device so that when they're interacting with people on social media, if that person had been anti-trans, their name would come red. And if they hadn't engaged with trans content, it would be yellow. And if they were supportive of trans people, it would be green. And it just used this program that already they were able to identify that. And just seeing young people who have been that creative and are that thoughtful and are already finding ways to support themselves. And also just through talking to each other, having supportive groups where they build each other up and share information on how to be safe. I have a lot of hope that young people are already finding creative ways to help themselves out in the world.
Yeah, so we actually get this question a lot, especially because we do a lot of training across the country to anti-violence workers and other folks that are curious about this topic or are working and supporting survivors who experience tech abuse.
Here's Rhiannon again.
I think what folks don't necessarily understand is that if you break down what tech-facilitated gender-based violence is by behavior, instead of us using these big terms like tech abuse, online harm, stalkerware, for example, that don't necessarily have a set definition that folks, understand. If we break down what the abuser is actually doing by behavior, there are statutes like voyeurism, unauthorized use of a computer, criminal harassment, uttering threats, harassing communication, defamatory libel, indecent communication, intimidation, the publication of an intimate image without consent. Those are all statutes under the Criminal Code of Canada that already exist. Not to mention, a lot of provinces and territories have their own civil remedies for tech-facilitated gender-based violence, but the way we see it in our project is that the statutes and laws already exist within Canada. We just have to use them. Law enforcement has to be able or willing to investigate. The judicial system needs to recognize that the legal framework exists and be able to hold abusers accountable for their misuse of technology by using the framework that already exists.
Dr. Mendes had this to say.
There are existing laws on the books that do apply to digital context. So whether it's things like voyeurism or criminal harassment, which maybe kind of links to stalking, there are definitely laws in place. With things like non-consensual sharing of intimate images, that actually is against Canada's criminal code. And increasingly, provinces and territories are also introducing civil legislation to seek financial compensation or just to get images taken down. I think the truth, though, is that most people don't go down the legal route. It's really important to know what our rights are and to know what the laws are, but most people are going to be seeking tech solutions or kind of like interpersonal solutions, social solutions. The fact that tech-facilitated sexual violence is increasingly in the media, I'm seeing so many stories about it, really gives me hope that this is an issue that is being taken seriously. The fact that Canada is finally trying to introduce an online harms bill, even though we don't really know what it will look like, gives me hope. Again, the fact that there's a recognition that we need to take more structural action and not just piecemeal, which is what's happening right now. So I'm hopeful that we are going to see legislation that holds social media companies accountable. I think that's incredibly important, that there's oversight on what's going on. Because right now, I can tell you, people report things to social media and they do or they don't take action. But there is no, you know, like if you ask for content to be taken down and they say no, there's no other avenue for you to go to. So I think that we need someone or a body above social media companies to complain to, like an ombudsman or like a safety office. And I think that that's one thing that really excites me about the possibility of this online harms bill, is that there can be some place for people to go to when they don't get the justice that they ask for through the social media companies. Yeah, so those are some things that give me hope.
We did try something unusual during the pandemic because, and we haven't done it much since, but we probably will. We set up an Amazon wish list because a lot of people were, you know, kind of scrolling through Facebook, and a lot of people like to buy a certain thing.
Again, here's Jody McDavid.
Some people don't want to just give you $20. They want to like specifically buy something. And so we had stuff on the list, like craft type supplies and, flip-flops, and, you know, because people want shower shoes and things like that. And we had, you know, leggings and pajamas and all that kind of stuff. And then also if somebody came in with a really specific need, we'd be able to put that on. So that was really good. People really enjoyed that.
Well, I think there's some obvious fixes. I think one of the biggest fixes is that social media companies need to do better. And so right now we're starting to see legislation introduced here in Canada. The Online Harms Bill has been put forward around requiring social media companies to address and research the potential harms on their sites and then having a legal obligation to mitigate the risks, because social media companies often have the most power and ability to react swiftly compared to law, compared to teachers, compared to all of these things. So I think one of the biggest fixes is social media companies doing better.
Because I think the thing I've learned, and many people have learned this, is that these tech companies are not benevolent. Their whole aim is to keep you on the platform as long as possible to generate more income, to gather more data about you. That is their only aim. They may say that they're there to facilitate connection and friendship. It's just simply not true. The way that they act is simply not true. So we can't expect them to kind of change for the better. They're not going to. So we need systems in place to really hold them accountable and make them act responsibly and ethically. And I think that needs to be the priority for government going forward.
As technology leaps forward and we share our lives more and more online, cyberstalking and digital control will only become more and more central to the fight against intimate partner violence. If you've heard some of your own story in this episode and feel a need to reach out for some support, please find your local shelter at thans.ca. Also, if this podcast and its message resonates with you and you want to help us in our mission, reach out to your local transition house to hear what their needs are. Each shelter has their own website that you can get directed to from thans.ca.